Part 5. The Last Phoenix. Chapter 21. The Iron Forge had become Ferus Manus's refuge since the monstrous betrayal visited upon him by his once brother. Its gleaming walls were cracked, the Primarch's hurt reaching out to destroy the things he held dear in fury at the treachery given voice here. Gabriel Santa stepped over weapons and armour strewn across the floor, many pieces twisted as though melted in the heart of a fire. He carried with him a data slate with fresh news from Terra. He hoped that it would lift his Primarch out of the anger-fueled depression that had settled upon him like a shroud in the wake of the traitor's scheme to sway the Iron Hands to the cause of treachery. Every artificer, forge master, tech marine and labourer had worked unceasingly to repair the damage done to their ships by the surprise attack of the Emperor's Children fleet. And, in an unbelievable time, the ships of the 52nd Expedition had been ready to make for Terra and bring warning of the War Master's perfidy. In this, however, they had been stymied as the ships, navigators and astropaths had been unable to penetrate the warp. Monstrous storms of terrifying force erupting through the depths of the Immaterium, preventing any contact with or from Terra. To venture into the warp while it raged and seethed with unnatural vigour was tantamount to suicide. But it had taken all of Gabriel Santar's calming words to break through Ferus Manus's towering fury and persuade him to await the end of the storms. 100 astropaths had died in attempts to penetrate the rolling miasma of churning warp storms, but though their heroic sacrifice was commemorated on the Iron Column, their efforts were in vain, and the Iron Hands remained incommunicado. For weeks, the ships of the 52nd Expedition travelled by conventional plasma engines, hoping to locate a break in the warp storms, but it seemed as though the realm beyond was at odds with them, for the navigators could see no way to break through and live. Ferus Manus had raged the length and breadth of the Fist of Iron at the injustice of surviving such treachery, only to be prevented from bringing word of it to the Emperor by something as mundane as a warp storm. When Astropath Sistor had brought word that his surviving choristers were at last receiving faint messages hurled out across the stars, the news had been greeted with great joy until they had been deciphered and transferred to the command logic engines. All across the Imperium, war was raging. On countless worlds, traitorous curs were revolting against their loyal leaders. Many Imperial commanders had declared for Horus and were denouncing the rule of the Emperor. Many of these traitors had launched attacks against neighbouring systems still loyal to the Imperium, and the rise of war was threatening to engulf the entire galaxy. Horus had spread his net of corruption wide, and it would take heroics the likes of which had forged the Imperium in the first place to save the Emperor's dream of a united galaxy. Even the Mechanicum had been drawn into rebellion as warring factions fought for control of the great forges of Mars. The Astartes armour manufacturing facilities were coming under particularly heavy attack, and the Emperor's loyal servants cried out for reinforcements as their enemies deployed ancient weapons technologies that had long been forbidden. Worse still, reports of alien attacks on human-held worlds were increasing with an alarming rapidity. The Greenskins rampaged through the southern galactic rim. The savage hordes of Caladan laid waste to newly compliant worlds in the region of storms. And the foul Carrion Eaters of Carnus V laid bloody claim to the 9 Vectors. As humanity was ripping itself apart with internecine warfare, countless Xeno breeds were rising to feed on the carcass. The Primarch of the Iron Hands hunched over the anvil in the centre of the forge, flickering blue fire blazing around his glowing silver hands as he worked a long length of gleaming metal upon it. The Primarch's wounds had healed swiftly, but his jaw still jutted pugnaciously where his treacherous brother had smashed the stolen forgebreaker against his skull. Even the mention of the traitor's name was forbidden. and Santar had never seen his Primarch so wrathful. Santar knew he himself was lucky to be alive, the grievous wound inflicted by the first captain of the Emperor's children having torn through his heart, lungs, and stomach. Only the timely ministrations of the Legion's apothecaries and a determination to wreak bloody vengeance upon Julius Caesaron had kept him alive long enough for him to have his ruined flesh replaced with bionic components. The grim figure of Astropath Sistor followed behind him, robed in cream and black, clutching his copper staff in a white-knuckled grip. The telepath's gaunt features were unreadable in the flickering firelight of the forge, but even one as dulled to psychic vibrations as Santar was could sense his concern. Ferrus Manus looked up as they approached, his grim, battered face a mask of cold iron anger. The restriction on entry to the Iron Forge had been forgotten, such petty rules and regulations deemed nonsensical in the face of the crisis facing the Imperium.
"Well," demanded Ferrus, "why do you disturb me?"
Santar allowed himself a tight smile and said, "I bring word from Rogel Dorn."
"From Dorn?"
cried Ferrus, the fire of his hands diminishing and his face alight with sudden savage interest. He placed the glowing metal upon the anvil and said,
"I thought the astropathic choirs could not yet reach Terra."
"Until a few hours ago we could not," agreed Sistor, stepping forward to stand next to Santar. "The warp storms that frustrated our every effort at communication over the previous weeks have dissipated utterly, and my choristers are receiving the most urgent communiques from Lord Dorn."
"This is great news indeed, Sistor," exclaimed Ferrus. "My compliments to your staff. Now, speak, Gabriel, speak. What does Dorn say?"
"My lord, if I may," said Sistor before Santar could answer, "this sudden calming of the warp disturbs me."
"Disturbs you, Sistor?" asked Ferrus. "Why? Surely it is a good thing."
"That remains to be seen, my lord. It is my belief that some external force has acted upon the warp, aiding our efforts to navigate through it and to send messages across the void of space."
"Why would you think this is a bad thing, Sistor?" asked Santar. "Might not the Emperor have worked to achieve this?"
"That is certainly a possibility," conceded Sistor, "but it is only one of many. I would be remiss in my duties if I did not voice my concern that some other agent, perhaps one of our enemies, is calming the sea of souls."
"Your concerns are noted, Astropath," snapped Ferrus. "Now, will one of you tell me what you have received from Dorn before I have to beat it out of you?"
Santar quickly held out the data slate and said, "The Emperor's champion sends word of his plans to destroy Horus." Ferrus snatched the slate from him as Santar continued. "It appears as though the Warmaster's treachery is confined to those legions that fought with him at Istvan III. As Sistor here says, the adepts of the Astropathic Corps have finally managed to establish contact with a great many of your brother Primarchs, and even now they are mobilizing against Horus."
"At last," snarled Ferrus, his silver eyes quickly scanning the data slate. A grim smile of measured triumph spread slowly across his face. "Salamanders, Alpha Legion, Iron Warriors, Word Bearers, Raven Guard and Night Lords, including the Iron Hands. That's 7 entire legions. Horus doesn't stand a chance."
"No, he doesn't," agreed Santar. "Dorn is being thorough."
"Indeed he is," said Ferrus. "Istvan V."
"My lord?"
"It seems Horus has established his headquarters on Istvan V, and it is there we are to crush his rebellion once and for all."
Ferrus handed back the data slate and said,
"Send word to Captain Balhan on the Ferrum that I shall be transferring my flag to his ship. Tell him to ready his vessel for immediate transit to the Istvan system. Deploy as many of the Morlocks as are fit to fight into its barracks. The rest of the Legion will have to make best speed and join us as soon as they are able." Santar frowned as Ferris returned to the glowing metal on the anvil and glanced down at the data slate to ensure he had not misread the orders it contained, orders that came directly from the Emperor's champion. He hesitated just long enough for Ferris to catch his delay and said, "My lord, our orders are to rendezvous with the full force of our legion." Ferris shook his head.
"No, Gabriel, I won't be denied my vengeance on him by arriving late and allowing others to destroy him first. The Ferum suffered the least amount of damage in the betrayal of the Emperor's children, and it's the fastest ship in the fleet. I need to face him and destroy him to restore my honour and prove my loyalty, Gabriel."
"Honour? Loyalty?" said Santa. "None could doubt your loyalty or honour, my lord. The traitor came to you with falsehoods, and you hurled them back in his face. If anything, you stand as an example to us all, a faithful and dutiful son of the Emperor. How could you even think such a thing?"
"Because others will," said Ferris,
picking up the long, flat metal on the anvil, an angry, fiery glow building in the silver depths of his hands.
"Fulgrim would not have risked attempting to turn me to the War Master's cause unless he truly believed I would join him. He must have seen weakness in me that made him think he would be successful. That is what I must purge in the heat of his blood. Though they might not voice such things openly, others will soon come to the same conclusion. You mark my words?"
"They would not dare."
"They will, my friend," nodded Ferris. "They will wonder what made Fulgrim risk such a dangerous gambit. Soon they will come to believe that perhaps he had reason to think I would follow him into treachery. No, we will make all speed for the Istvan system to wash away the stain of this dishonour in the blood of traitors."
It took an effort of will not to approach the statue, and Ostian had to deliberately place the file on the battered metal stool next to him. Part of what made an artist great was knowing when something was finished, when it was time to put down the pen, the chisel, or the brush, and step away from it. The work belonged to the ages now. And as he looked up into the helmeted eyes of the Master of Mankind, he knew that it was finished. Towering above him, the pale marble was flawless, every curve of the Emperor's armour rendered with loving care to exactly replicate his majesty. Great shoulder guards, with eagles rampant, framed a tall helmet of ancient design topped with a long horsehair crest of such fine carving that even Ostian expected it to ruffle in the cool air fluttering the papers and dust around him. The great eagle on the Emperor's breastplate seemed as though it might burst from his chest, and the lightning bolts on his greaves and bracers exuded a raw power that energized the statue with a fierce anima. A long, curving cloak of white marble spilled down the back of the statue like a cascade of milk, and the Emperor's stature was such that he felt sure the Master of the Imperium might deign to look upon it with a moment of pleasure, to see his image rendered so. A wreath of gold set off the paleness of the marble, and Ostian felt his breath catch as something amazing took flight within him at the statue's perfection. Ostian had been called many things in his career, a perfectionist, an obsessive, but to his way of thinking, it took obsession and a quest for the truth of the details for an artist to be worthy of the name. Since receiving the block, the carving had taken him the best part of 2 years, his every waking moment spent working on the marble or thinking about the marble. Quick work by any method of measurement, but when placed against the final outcome, it was miraculous. Ordinarily, such a masterpiece would have taken much longer, but the changing character of the 28th expedition had troubled Ostian greatly, and he had not ventured beyond his studio for many months. He realized that he needed to reacquaint himself with events in the Great Crusade.
what new cultures had been met, what great deeds had recently been accomplished. The thought of leaving his studio filled him with trepidation and excitement, for with the unveiling of his statue, he would be able to once again bask in the adulation of admirers, something he normally detested, but which, at moments like these, he craved. No false modesty blinded Ostian to his talents, nay, his genius, in the moment following the completion of a piece of work. It would be in the days, weeks, and months to come that flaws only he could see would become apparent, and he would curse his useless hands and begin thinking of how to improve on his next work. If an artist should ever feel that he could no longer better himself, then what was the point of being an artist? Each work should be like unto a stepping stone that led to greater and greater heights of artistry, where a man could look back at his life's works and be satisfied that he had made the most of his allotted span. Ostian removed his smock and neatly folded it before placing it upon the stool, taking exaggerated care to flatten the dulled fabric before stepping back. To admire his own work so avidly, now that it was finished, was unseemly, but when it was made public, it would no longer be his, and his alone. It would belong to everyone who saw it, and a million critical eyes would judge its worth or lack thereof. At moments like this, he could begin to understand the self-destructive kernel of doubt that lurked in Serena D'Angelis's heart, or indeed any artist's, be they painter, sculptor, writer, or composer. Within the artist's work was a portion of his soul, and the fear of rejection or ridicule was potent indeed. A cold gust made him shiver, and a lilting voice said, "You have certainly captured him." Ostian jumped and spun around to see the terrifying, beautiful form of the Primarch of the Emperor's Children standing before him. Unusually, the Phoenix Guard was absent, and Ostian found himself beginning to sweat, despite the coolness of his studio. "My lord," he said, dropping to one knee, "forgive me, I did not hear you enter." Fulgrim nodded and swept past him, swathed in a long purple toga embroidered with dazzling silver wrapped around his powerful physique. The golden hilt of a sword protruded from beneath the toga, and a crown of barbed laurels sat upon his noble brow. The Primarch's face was rendered doll-like by the application of thick white grease paint and brightly coloured, overpoweringly scented inks around his eyes and lips. What the Primarch hoped to achieve with his facial embellishments, Ostian did not know, but unless it was to appear vulgar and grotesque, it had failed completely. Like one of the theatrical performers of old Earth, Fulgrim carried himself with regal authority. He waved Ostian to his feet as he stopped before the statue, his expression unreadable beneath the layers of paint. "I remember him like this," said Fulgrim. Ostian heard a note of sadness in the Primarch's voice. "That was many years ago, of course. He looked like this at Ulanor, but that's not how I remember him on that day. He was cold then, aloof even." Ostian rose to his feet, but kept his eyes averted from the Primarch, lest he see his disquiet at his appearance. His earlier pride in the statue vanished the instant Fulgrim looked upon it, and he held his breath as he awaited the Primarch's critical opinion. Fulgrim turned to face him, his grotesque mask of grease paint and oil cracking in a smile. Ostian relaxed a fraction, and even though the flat, gem-like eyes of utter darkness remained unmoved, he saw a hostility there that terrified him. The smile fell from the Primarch's face, and he said, "That you carve a statue of the Emperor at a time like this shows either willful stupidity on your part or reprehensible ignorance, Ostian."
Ostian felt his composure crack at Fulgrim's pronouncement, and he tried in vain to think of something to say in response. Fulgrim walked towards him, and a suffocating fear rose in Ostian's fragile body, his terror at the Primarch's displeasure rooting him to the spot. The commander of the Emperor's children circled him, the towering presence of the Primarch threatening to overwhelm what remained of Ostian's resolve.
"My lord," he whispered.
"You spoke," snapped Fulgrim, reaching down to turn him around so that his back was to the statue. "A worm like you does not deserve to speak to me. You who told me that my work was too perfect creates a work such as this. Perfect in every detail, perfect in every detail, but one."
Ostian looked up into the black pools of the Primarch's eyes, but even through his terror he saw a tortured anguish that transcended his own fear, a conflicted soul at war with itself. He saw the lust to do him harm and the desire to beg his forgiveness in the depths of the Primarch's eyes.
"My lord, Fulgrim," said Ostian through tears that spilled freely down his cheeks, "I do not understand."
"No,"
said Fulgrim, advancing towards him and forcing him step by step towards the statue.
"You don't, do you? Like the Emperor, you have been too enraptured by your own selfish desires to pay any mind to that which goes on around you. Remembrances vanished and friends betrayed. When all you once held dear is crumbling around you, what do? You abandon those closest to you and forsake them in the quest for something of supposedly higher purpose."
Ostian's terror reached new heights as he bumped into the marble of the statue, and Fulgrim leaned down so that his painted face was level with his own. Yet, even amid the flood of horror at what had become of the Primarch, Ostian pitied him too, for there was great pain in his every tortured word.
"If you had bothered to take note of your surroundings and the great events in motion, you would have dashed this sculpture to ruins and begged me to become the subject of your latest work. A new order is rising in the galaxy, and the Emperor is no longer its master."
"What?"
gasped Ostian in surprise. Fulgrim laughed, the sound bitter and desperate.
"Horus will be the new master of the Imperium," cried Fulgrim, drawing the sword from beneath his toga with a flourish.
The golden hilt shimmered in the brightness of the studio, and Ostian felt warm wetness run down his thighs at the loathsome sight of the soulless blade. Fulgrim drew himself up to his full height, and Ostian sobbed in relief as the Primarch's haunted eyes broke contact with his own.
"Yes, Ostian," said Fulgrim matter-of-factly. "For the past week, the pride of the Emperor has been in orbit over Istvan V, a bleak and blackened world of no particular note, but one which will go down in history as a place of glorious legend."
Ostian fought to control his breathing as Fulgrim circled behind the statue, and he sagged against the cool marble.
"For on this dusty, unremarkable world, the War Master will utterly destroy the might of the Emperor's most loyal legions in preparation for our march to Terra," continued Fulgrim. "You see, Ostian, Horus is the rightful master of mankind. He is the one who has led us to triumphs undreamt of. He is the one who has conquered 10,000 worlds, and he is the one who will lead us in conquest of 10,000 more. Together we will cast down the false Emperor."
Ostian's thoughts tumbled over one another as he struggled to come to grips with the enormity of what Fulgrim was suggesting. Betrayal dripped from every word, and Ostian was suddenly and horribly confronted with the fact that he was paying the price for his isolation. Shutting himself off from events simply because he did not care for them had led to this, and he wished he had taken the time to...
"Your work is not yet perfect, Ostian," said Fulgrim from behind the statue.
Ostian tried to frame a reply when he heard a horrific scraping sound of metal on stone, and the tip of the Primarch's alien sword burst through the marble plinth to spear between his shoulder blades. The glittering grey blade emerged from his chest with a crack of bone. Ostian tried to scream in pain, but his mouth filled with blood as the blade pierced his heart. The Primarch's strength drove the blade deeper into the statue until the gold quillons clanged against the marble and the tip of the sword projected a full foot from Ostian's chest. Blood flowed from his mouth in thick red runnels of saliva, and his eyes dimmed. Ostian's life flowed from his body as though clawed out by some voracious predator. Ostian looked up with the last of his strength as he dimly perceived Fulgrim standing before him once more. The Primarch looked at him with a mixture of contempt and regret, pointing at the blood-spattered statue he hung from. "Now it's perfect," said Fulgrim. The gallery of swords on the Andronius had changed a great deal since Lucius had last walked its length. Where once an avenue of monolithic statues of great heroes had stared down and judged the worth of a warrior as he walked between them, now those same statues had been crudely altered with hammers and chisels to resemble strange, bull-headed monsters with gem-studded armour and curling horns of bone. Brightly coloured paints had been daubed over the statues, and the overall effect was like that of some garish carnival parade. Eidolon marched ahead of him, and Lucius could feel the Lord Commander's dislike of him as an almost physical resentment. His killing of Chaplain Charmosian still sat ill with Eidolon, and he had called him a traitor twice over. But that seemed an age ago, when the loyalist fools on Istvan III had still resisted the inevitable. Lucius had given the Lord Commander the opportunity to win a great victory on a silver platter, and, like the fool he was, Eidolon had squandered his chance for glory. When Lucius had slaughtered his warriors, the eastern approaches to the palace were wide open, and Eidolon had led the Emperor's children into the palace to outflank the defenders and roll up their pathetic defiance in a tide of fire and blood. But he had overreached himself and left his forces exposed to a counter-attack. It was an unforgivable oversight, and one that Saul Tarvitz had punished him for, flanking the flankers. Lucius still smarted at his last confrontation with Tarvitz, remembering the duel they had fought in the ruined dome where he had killed Solomon Demeter. Like Loken before him, Tarvitz had not fought honourably, and Lucius had been lucky to escape with his life. Still, it didn't matter any more. After he had rejoined his legion, the War Master's forces had withdrawn from Istvan III and commenced an orbital bombardment that had pulverized the surface of the planet until not a single structure remained standing. The Precentor's palace was a ruin of vitrified stone, and the force of the bombardment had levelled even the might of the Siren Hold. Nothing lived on Istvan III, and Lucius felt a thrill of delicious excitement as he considered the future the fates had opened up to him. He paused to savour the heights of glory he would rise to, and the new sensations awaiting him as he marched at the side of his Primarch once more. The statue before him had once been Lord Commander Teliosa, hero of the Madrivane campaign, and Lucius remembered Tarvitz telling him that he had especially honoured it. He chuckled as he imagined what Saul Tarvitz would make of the carved horns and exposed breast that had been added to it by enthusiastic, if questionably skilled, sculptors. "Apothecary Fabius is waiting," snapped Eidolon from up ahead, his impatience obvious. Lucius grinned and spun on his heel to join Eidolon at his leisure. "I know, but he can wait a little longer. I was admiring the changes you've made to the ship." Eidolon scowled and said, "If it were up to me, I'd have left you to die down there."
"Then I'm grateful it wasn't up to you," smirked Lucius. "Still, after your defeat at Saul's hands, I'm surprised you retained your command."
"Tarvitz," growled Eidolon. "A thorn in my side from the day he made captain."
"Well, he's a thorn no longer, Lord Commander," said Lucius, thinking back to his last sight of Istvan III, the swirling, cloud-streaked glow of its atmosphere flickering with the mushroom clouds of high-yield atomics and incendiaries.
"You saw him die?" asked Eidolon.
Lucius shook his head.
"No, but I saw what was left of the palace. Nothing could have lived through that. Tarvitz is dead, and so are Loken and that smug bastard, Torgadon."
Eidolon at least had the good grace to smile at the news of Torgadon's death, and he nodded reluctantly.
"That at least is good news. What are the others? Solomon Demeter, ancient Rylanor?"
Lucius laughed as he remembered Solomon Demeter's death.
"Demeter is dead. Of that I am certain."
"How can you be so sure?"
"Because I killed him," said Lucius. "He happened upon me when I was dispatching the warriors assigned to defend the eastern ruins of the palace, and happily joined in when I shouted to him that I was under attack."
Eidolon smirked as he understood.
"You mean Demeter killed his own men?"
"Indeed he did," said Lucius, "with great gusto."
Eidolon let out a burst of laughter, and Lucius could feel the Lord Commander's attitude thaw a fraction at the irony of Solomon Demeter's final moments.
"An ancient Rylanor?"
asked Eidolon, leading him further along the gallery of swords to the entrance to the apothecarian.
"I don't know for sure about that," said Lucius. "After the bombing, he took himself off into the depths of the Precentor's palace. I never saw him again."
"Not like Rylanor to run from a fight," noted Eidolon,
turning a corner and marching down a parchment-lined corridor that led to the grand staircase of the ship's central apothecarian.
"No," agreed Lucius, "though Tarvitz did say something about him guarding something."
"Guarding what?"
"He didn't say. Rumour was he'd found some kind of underground hangar. But if that were the case, then why didn't Prahl use it to escape when the legions arrived?"
"True," agreed Eidolon. "It is the nature of the coward to flee rather than fight. Well, no matter whatever Rylanor's purpose, it is irrelevant, for he is buried beneath thousands of tons of radioactive slag."
Lucius nodded and gestured down the stairs.
"Apothecary Fabius, what exactly is he going to do to me?"
"Is that fear I hear in your voice, Lucius?" asked Eidolon.
"No,"
said Lucius.
"I just want to know what I'm letting myself in for."
"Perfection," promised Eidolon.
The corridors of the Pride of the Emperor were never quiet now, hastily rigged mesh speakers blaring a constant cacophony of sound from La Fenice. After hearing a taster of the Maravigilia's overture, Fulgrim had commanded that his vessels be filled with music, and the weirdly distorted recordings of Bekwakinska's symphonics echoed along every hallway, day and night. Serena D'Angelus made her way along the dazzlingly bright corridors of Fulgrim's flagship, lurching from side to side like a drunk, her clothes stained with blood and ordure. The remains of her long hair were greasy, and matted clumps of it had been torn out in her ravings. With the completion of the paintings of Lucius and Fulgrim, she had found herself without inspiration, as though the fire that had driven her to undreamt-of highs and lows had burnt itself out. Days passed without her moving from her studio, and the month since the expedition had arrived in the Istvan system had passed in a blur of catatonia and horrified introspection. Dreams and nightmares had played out in her head like badly cut picked reels. Images of horrors and degradation she hadn't known she was capable of visualizing, tormenting her with their intensity and hideousness. Scenes of murders, violations, desecrations, and things so vile that surely a human being was incapable of indulging in them without losing their sanity, played out before her like some madman's fever dreams, laid out for her unwilling scrutiny.
Occasionally she remembered to eat, not recognising the wild, feral woman she saw in the mirror, or the scarred flesh that greeted her every morning when she awoke naked in the ruin of her studio. Over the weeks, the suspicion grew in her mind that the repeated visions that plagued her in the night were not simply delusions, they were memories. She remembered weeping bitter tears as her suspicions were terrifyingly confirmed the day she had opened the stinking barrel in the corner of the studio. A reek of decomposing human meat and acidic chemicals hit her like a blow, and the lid clattered to the floor as she saw the gooey, partially dissolved remains of at least 6 corpses, smashed skulls, sawn bones, and a thick soup of liquefying flesh sloshed around the barrel, and Serena vomited uncontrollably for several minutes at the horror of the sight. She dragged herself away from the barrel and wept piteously as the full abhorrence of what she had done threatened to overwhelm her already fraying sanity. Her mind had teetered on the brink of madness until a name had surfaced in the miasma of her consciousness, a name that gave her an anchor to cling to. Ostian. 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 Like a drowning woman clutching at a branch, she had pulled herself to her feet, cleaned herself up as best she could, and stumbled, weeping and bloody, towards Ostian's studio. He had tried to help her, and she had rejected him, seeing now the love that had motivated his altruism and cursing herself for not realizing it sooner. Ostian could save her. As she reached the shutter to his studio, she only hoped he had not forsaken her. The shutter was partially open, and she slammed her palm against the corrugated metal. "Ostian," she cried, "it's me, Serena. Please let me in." Ostian did not reply, and she beat her hands bloody on the shutter, screaming his name and sobbing as she cried and begged for his forgiveness. Still there was no reply, and in desperation she reached down and lifted the shutter. Serena stumbled into the dimly lit studio, detecting a dreadful, familiar smell, even before her exhausted eyes made out the loathsome sight before her. "Oh, no," she whispered, as she saw the grisly sight of Ostian's body impaled upon a glittering sword blade protruding from a wondrous sculpture of the Emperor. She dropped to her knees before him and screamed, "Forgive me! I didn't know what I was doing! Oh, please forgive me, Ostian!" What remained of Serena's mind finally buckled and collapsed inwards at this latest atrocity. She pushed herself to her feet and placed her hands on Ostian's shoulders. "You loved me," she whispered, "and I never saw it." Serena closed her eyes and wrapped her arms around Ostian's corpse, feeling the sharp tip of the sword between her breasts. "But I loved you too," she said, and pulled herself hard onto the sword blade.